Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the best things about BetterHelp is that treatment is discreet and convenient. I know that especially in a small town, it might be difficult to find treatment, or it may be intimidating because small town gossip spreads like wildfire. You shouldn't feel judged for seeking help with your mental health. But if that's what's been holding you back, fear not, BetterHelp is here to save the day. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera unless you want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. And thanks to the great people at BetterHelp, I have a special offer for Obscure History listeners. You can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/obscure. That's betterhelp.com/obscure. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. Spring is in the air. Birds are singing, the sun is shining, and unfortunately, weeds are growing. For millions of Americans and maybe even billions of people worldwide, spring means gardening. Though it is a hobby for most, it can feel like a full-time job. You've got to prepare the soil, eliminate the weeds, tediously care for the seeds, make sure that your little plants are not underwatered or overwatered, or that they have too much or too little shade, and most of all, you need to keep the pests away. Birds, moles, and tiny insects. It really is a lot to consider. But what if, in addition to all of those responsibilities, you also had to care for a very strange person? My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. Gardens have long been an envied possession, and I totally get why. Imagine you walk out into your backyard. It's spring, and the earth seems to hum with life. Birds have returned from their winter travels and are filling the air with their sweet songs. Butterflies freely flutter, stretching their wings in the spring sun. Ladybugs and spiders dance beneath blades of grass and leaves of trees. The green patches that first burst forth from the thawing winter soil have sprouted tall emerald stems and petals of every shape and color. The world seems happy as golden rays of sun illuminate everything in sight. But more exciting than the birds or insects or small colorful flowers is the promise of your garden. The rich brown soil that you've carefully curated is awaiting seeds so it can begin its work. Work which will bring you a tangible prize. Tomatoes of every shape and size, radishes, carrots, and potatoes that will hide just below the surface of the earth, waiting to surprise you with their bounty. Herbs and spices that will fill your house with their playful and intoxicating aromas. And beyond the instant gratification of raising a juicy strawberry or blueberry from a tiny seed, there is the promise of things to come. Salsa shared with friends and family. Cucumbers that will be canned and transformed into crisp pickles. Fresh mint for date night mojitos. From the garden, you see the potential for connection. For laughter, tears, announcements, apologies. In a garden, you see possibilities. As Aubrey Hepburn once famously recalled, to plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow. That obviously sounds idyllic, like something out of a fairy tale. And it is for that reason that they are highly coveted. Sadly, only about 25% of Americans are able to pursue gardening activities. For this, there are a couple of very clear reasons. If you have a garden, you own land. This is problematic for those who hope to grow a garden because many people in metropolitan areas live directly next to, below, or above their neighbors. Similarly, many suburban homes have yards where a garden could potentially be planted, but due to the available space, it may not be prudent. More nefariously, the ability to garden is dependent upon one's ability to own land, and at various points on our human timeline, this ability has been tightly guarded and heavily restricted. In American history, the availability of land and one's ability to own it depended greatly upon one's race. In fact, we are still feeling the harmful effects of predatory and systemic practices like redlining, which restricted access to capital to certain individuals based upon their race. Because of the exclusivity of land ownership historically, gardening has been a sort of status symbol for generations. People who are able to often adorn their gardens with decor, elaborate landscaping, fountains, and birdhouses. Now, naturally, the extent to which people use their garden as a symbol of their socioeconomic status is dependent upon the condition of the economy. During the World Wars, those fighting the war on the home front were strongly encouraged by the government to grow their own food. These wartime gardens were not ornate or extravagant. They were gardens of necessity. Inversely, in times of flourishing economies, gardens have been lavish. Comically so, truthfully. In the 18th century, there was a gardening trend among the most wealthy of Britain's residents. In the gardens of their massive, sprawling estates, British elites would stage a scene in a sort of life-sized diorama. They would transform a portion of their garden into the home of a mysterious hermit. To achieve this effect, British nobles would set up a sort of playhouse at the mouth of a cave, or they might even assemble a sort of makeshift tent or cabin to give the illusion that there may be a strange resident inside. The wealthiest of Britain's nobles would actually build small houses for their pretend occupants. Now, this practice could be compared to building a fairy garden today. For those that don't have young nieces like I do, a fairy garden is a sort of miniature house that children make. They often feature cool rocks, miniature plants, little model houses, and other things that might entertain a fairy who is looking for a nice place to rest. If the child believes hard enough when they create the fairy garden, the fairies might even leave them a little prize behind to show their gratitude. The British practice of ornamental hermitage was exactly like that, except for it was full-sized, and instead of attracting fairies, the goal was to attract wise old men. For example, in my niece's fairy garden, there are cool, colorful rocks, glitter, and shiny things. You know, things that a fairy would like. In the garden of a wealthy nobleman, you would find a shack built into a cave opening with a table, chair, stack of classic literature, and a pair of reading glasses. You know, things that would attract a wise old man. Now, this seems strange to us today, and for good reason. I've never wanted an old man to wander onto my property. I don't really think that's a thing that people want anymore, but at the time, ornamental hermitages were all the rage, and all the wealthy aristocrats wanted to have the best one. Not surprisingly, the wealthiest of the wealthy were able to take their ornamental hermitages to the next level. Starting as early as the 15th or early 16th century, wealthy landowning aristocrats in Great Britain sought to lord their status over their fellow nobles and the common rabble alike, a compulsion that seems to continue on. At first, it was having a luxurious and spacious garden. Then it was building a second estate into the garden specifically for the purpose of playing pretend, an attempt to lure in a mythological wise man. But then, the richest of the rich, the most privileged and influential, actually began stocking their gardens with real old men, as if they were goldfish in a pond. The lords of the estate would procure an old man from the throngs of commoners, promising them free room and board, as well as a small stipend, on the condition that they stay in the garden. Upon agreement, those old men would indenture themselves to the lords of the estate, contractually obligated to remain in the garden's hermitage, acting like a real-life hermit. On Monday morning, old Brutus was just the village's unemployed fisherman, but by Tuesday evening he was draped in a mysterious cloak, being paid to sit around and look at books in a makeshift hovel all day and night. The ornamental hermitages were slowly filled with real-life, living and breathing ornamental hermits. Sometimes these hired hermits were simply silent actors, like a giant moving diorama. Other times they were available to give guests tours or personal advice, like a legendary sage. Some were mysterious, performing mock rituals and acting like a druid from days gone by. Most of these ornamental hermits have been lost to the sands of time. Their names and identities have all been but forgotten. One very interesting man, however, went from advising visitors in the garden of an aristocrat to advising kings and queens. But before we get to the extravagant and strange life of Francis of Paola, we need to Paola our own bills. If you want ad-free episodes with bonus content, then hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts. If you want bonus content for free, follow the show notes and join us on the Discord server. Come chat with like-minded history nerds. Did I mention that it's free? Born to devoutly religious parents in Paola, Italy in 1416, Francis of Paola was the pride and joy of his parents, who had been praying and hoping for him for years. In fact, they were so overjoyed that God had brought them a son that they named him after Saint Francis of Assisi. Though their prayers had been answered, things were not perfect. In fact, Francis of Paola contracted a swelling disease while he was still in the crib. The swelling spread to his eyes, and while clutched with panic and fear, his parents made a bargain with God. If he would spare their precious baby boy from this strange affliction, he would spend the rest of his life spreading the word. Subsequently, the swelling passed, and Francis of Paola's odd life was set into motion. At the age of 13, Francis began seeing a supernatural vision of a Franciscan friar. Shortly after he began seeing these visions, his parents sent him to a friary to begin his initiation into the Franciscan order. After taking multiple religious pilgrimages, Francis decided to settle down in a secluded cave in a luxurious garden, where he could be considered to have been the very first ornamental hermit. But that's just the beginning of his wild story. After living in this cave for 6 years, devoting himself to fasting and prayer the entire time, Francis decided to start his own order of monks. In 1435, two companions joined him in his retreat, and to accommodate them, Francis built 3 cells and a chapel, giving a corporate structure to their religious getaway. By 1436, he and 2 followers began a movement that would become the foundation of the Hermits of St. Francis of Assisi, which would later be renamed to the Minim Friars. In addition to the traditional Franciscan values of poverty, chastity, and obedience, the Minim Friars had a strongly held 4th vow. This 4th vow regulated their diets and made the Minim Friars vegan about 400 years before the first modern vegan diets were advertised. The Minim Friars refused to eat any animal byproducts, and, in an effort to emulate the fasting of Lent, they held this diet year-round, year after year. The rule of life adopted by Francis and his religion was one of extraordinary severity. He felt that heroic mortification was necessary as a means for spiritual growth. Despite seeking a life of extreme obscurity, his unique devotion actually brought a tremendous amount of attention to his order. The number of his disciples gradually increased, and by about 1454, with the permission of Pyrrhus, Archbishop of Cosenza, Francis built a large monastery and church. The building of this monastery was the occasion of a great outburst of enthusiasm and devotion on the part of the people towards Francis. Even the nobles carried stones and joined the work. Now, it wasn't just his unique beliefs that attracted people. Nobles don't move stones for any old monk. Francis had almost a Christ-like reputation. According to legend, in the year 1464, he was refused passage by a boatman while trying to cross the Strait of Messina to Sicily. He reportedly laid his cloak on the water, tied one end to his staff as a sail, and sailed across the strait, with his companions following in a boat. Another extraordinary tale that circulated widely says that after his nephew died, the boy's mother, Francis's sister, appealed to Francis for comfort and filled his apartment with lamentations. After the Mass and divine office had been said for the repose of his soul, Francis ordered the corpse to be carried from the church into his cell, where he continued praying for him until, to her great astonishment, the boy's life was restored and he returned to his mother. Other tales in accordance with his vegan beliefs suggest that he went out of his way to perform miracles for animals whose fate was leading them to the butcher block. For example, a biographer writes, Francis had a favorite trout that he called Antonella. One day, one of the priests who provided religious services saw the trout swimming about in the pool. To him, it was just a delicious feast, so he caught it, took it home, tossed it into the frying pan to eat. Francis missed Antonella and realized what had happened. He asked one of his followers to go to the priest and get it back. The priest, annoyed by this great concern for just a fish, threw the cooked trout upon the ground, shattering it into several pieces. The hermit sent by Francis gathered up the broken pieces in his hands and brought them back to Francis. Francis placed the pieces back in the pool, looked to heaven and prayed, "Antonella, in the name of charity, return to life." The trout immediately became whole and swam joyously around the pool as if nothing had happened. Shockingly, this very peculiar man eventually found himself giving counsel directly to King Louis XI. As King Louis XI sensed his end was near, he called upon Francis in hopes that he would perform one of his famous miracles and extend the king's life. He was unable to perform such a miracle, but in the process became such a close ally to the king that King Louis XI actually built a chapel specifically for the friars of Menin. During his time in France with the king, Francis, in addition to serving as a direct advisor to the king, also served as a tutor to the heir to the throne, Charles VIII. After serving France's royal family for years and sensing that his own end was drawing near, Francis asked that he be released from his duties and sent back to his home in Italy. Unfortunately, his request was denied. So in expectation of the end, Francis hid himself away in the chapel. He called his order to him, appointed a vicar general to fill in his place after he was gone, and just as he started his career all alone in a cave, he ended his career all alone in a stone chapel. Francis of Paola's life was legendary, and it came to its conclusion in 1507, at the age of 91. After his death, he was canonized as a saint. But that's not the only thing that happened to him after his death. About 50 years after his death, religious strife was reaching a fever pitch in France. In the throes of passion and violence, a group of French Protestants dug the body of Saint Francis of Paola up, mashed his bones to dust, and scattered his remains into the wind. And perhaps it is here that we see the most poetic irony of all. Saint Francis's greatest aspiration in life was to be humble to the point of extreme obscurity. However, after his death, he was lauded and praised as a saint, a trailblazing miracle worker. But in the end, eventually, he was made fully obscure. So much so that his body no longer remains in its tomb. In fact, it doesn't exist at all. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate all of you so much. As always, this show is brought to you by Earbuds Podcast Collective and Indie Drop-In Network. Their links will always be in my show notes, unless, of course, I forget, but I usually don't forget. Also, in the show notes, you will find a link to the Discord. It is free. There are no strings attached at all. It's just a fun place to chat with like-minded history nerds. And myself. I check it somewhat regularly. It's the easiest way to get in touch with me if you've got ideas for episodes, or if you've got questions or comments about something you've heard on the show. It is by far the easiest way to get in touch with me directly and a community of like-minded nerds. I don't really have too many more exciting announcements for you, but I can give you a little teaser. There is a new ad that will be running next week, and I think that you will probably really enjoy the product. It is one of my very favorite deals that I've been able to work out, and I'm kind of still amazed that it's happening. I can't say much more, but stay tuned next week. It will be delicious and exciting.